So today I'm sitting down with Dan Abramov, and we're going to talk about the overwhelming success of his Redux library. Hi, Dan.
Hi.
So I was going through the end of the year stuff, and I was doing some database queries, and your Getting Started with Redux course on Egghead has, for the last 2 years, consistently, month over month, been like head and shoulders above every other course we have on the site in terms of popularity. We track usage, and people have spent six years, Dan, watching that Redux course.
Oh, man.
And that's only the people that are logged into our site. That does not include all the free views, which are astronomically high as well. I didn't get into that to calculate it, which is nuts to me. We pay royalties. It's into the six figures over the last 2 years. To me, it's like amazing. This Redux phenomenon, as I was kind of thinking about it. And have you like thought about like why Redux has blown up in the way that it has?
Yeah, I'm not sure really. I think I'm surprised by it as well, both by the popularity of the course and by popularity of Redux. I think the Redux phenomenon is weird to me because it relies on some concepts that I don't think have been mainstream. I think they were on the verge of becoming mainstream, and actually Redux kind of helped to push them to mainstream, like using immutability in client-side kind of JavaScript code. I mean, obviously there was a lot of prior art, and it's not like an innovative project in terms of it uses ideas from Ohm and from Elm and like a bunch of other projects that are a little bit less mainstream than Redux. And I was just chatting to somebody from a coding bootcamp a few months ago. And so this is a guy who learned web development basically during the last year. And so he told me that all these things like immutability and the kind of approach that Redux uses, this is natural to him. This is like what he learned. And this is so strange for me because when I was learning, everything was object-oriented and like there was a lot of dogma around it. And functional programming seems something that's not really accessible to most people, and it seemed more kind of academic. And it's so strange how the tide has turned. So I think, getting back to your question, I think it's just Redux just happened to be at that point in time when functional programming concepts were becoming more mainstream, and it just happened to kind of give a name to some of these patterns, even though it did not really invent those patterns. And I think people find these patterns useful, even if they don't use Redux. So like there's this NGRX project, which is inspired by Redux, that's popular in the Angular community. There's React itself, which obviously is not inspired by Redux, but some of the things that we did in Redux are kind of slowly making their way into React itself. So I think it's like its success is just because it gave a name to something, to some things that already existed and that people find valuable to these concepts. And people just want to learn these concepts.
Yeah, you mentioned like object-oriented programming, and I came up the same way, right? Like it was all, you know, I remember when I was starting to learn how to program, it was the Gang of Four. You know, I was reading it like it was the Bible and trying to, you know, really get in and understand these concepts. Do you think any of that like carries over though, like into JavaScript? It's totally different, and people like almost have stopped using the terminology from that book. But at the same time, if you read it, it's like you see, you know, some of these patterns, and even with Redux and this React programming that we do, I see some of those patterns. Have you seen anything? And would you say that there's a thread that goes through those?
Yeah, I think I have a history with that book. So when I was learning, development, I really liked making notes. So I had this book, Gang of Four book, and I it has these examples in Java and Smalltalk, and I didn't know either of them. I actually, I only knew Visual Basic at the time. So it was a bit hard to get through it. But I was fascinated by object-oriented programming at the time, and I would try to create a concept of the book, and I used like differently colored pens to like draw these diagrams and stuff. That was fun. In terms of how these concepts apply, I think one way of saying it is, like a lot of people say that, I think, that it's a lot of these concepts are less, less kind of necessary. They just kind of disappear. At least like their structural form disappears a little bit with functional programming, because once you have function as a first class concept, a lot of these things are just it's just functions that you can pass around. And a lot of the complexity in how these patterns are described, I think, disappears if you have a function as a first class value. But I do think that some of these, factory, come on, it's just a function that that you can call. But I think that some of these definitely are still valuable as ideas, and I think it's good to know them. And I think that some of them also translate to the functional world. Some of them translate less. There is a good book called Game Programming Patterns, I think it was called. That
is
I really
Jesse Schnell, I think is his name. Is that the one?
I'm not sure. I think he's currently writing about another book about creating VMs. So that's the same author. I don't remember his name, but basically it's a book that's there's a little more water in it compared to Design Patterns, I would say, but I found it enjoyable. And I think it revisits some of these patterns, but from perspective of a game programmer, and like think in terms of the game loop and how to structure your logic in a game. And I think modern front-end development, especially like React and React-like libraries and this kind of mindset, I think it has a lot to do with game development as well, because you have this complicated state, you have these many kind of like actors that are like components that have to talk to each other, but you want to render them efficiently, you want to separate the state from the drawing logic, and that's kind of what React does under the hood. You don't really think about it much, but I found that the patterns described in that book, and it sometimes references the Gough book as well, but I found it more relatable to what I do today. So I would recommend anyone to read it.
Yeah, we'll get the title of that too and put it in the show notes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me too. And if you think about like a game and how a game's built, because you have this very visual aspect of it, but then you also have the world, right? Like you have the state of the world that has to change at every frame, which is, you know, like that's effectively what Redux has done for us. And that was the thing that blew my mind actually with Redux, was the single immutable state was just like, it was like, you know, the skies opened for me in terms of how I thought about my applications.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, really been a benefit since then. So you talk a lot, or you have talked a lot in the past about developer experience and, you know, what we go through, kind of the experience we have as developers, which to me like relates to user experience in some ways. But, you know, I was wondering, you know, where this idea of developer experience kind of came from and, you know, what you've done since, you know, you started working on that to kind of push that forward.
I don't think I'm doing a great job at it. It's like there's a bunch of projects that I started that I didn't really follow through with, and it makes me feel a bit guilty, but also I feel like I'll fix them eventually. It just takes time. So where does this come from? I think a part of this is just I hate keeping things in my head. Like I'm not a very great learner, or it's hard for me to take a complicated application and try to remember everything that happens to it, and kind of try to remember what might be causing bugs, these kind of things. So I need any kind of debugging tools that I can get. And so I think it, I got a lot of, so I was working on an application a few years ago, before joining Facebook, before Redux. It was a really complex client-side application with a lot of state and a lot of kind of interactivity, and we wanted to cache data very aggressively and try to fetch as little as possible and try to make sure that it's consistent across as you navigate through the app and you do something. We want to make sure that anything you do is reflected in the like widgets you see and so on. And so we were using Backbone at first, and I found it very limiting in terms of it was hard for me to like to avoid race conditions and avoid, you know, the kind of bugs where you do something and some part of the UI gets into an inconsistent state and you're like, how do I reproduce this? I'm not sure, because like it happens only once in a while, or you don't really have login in place to tell what is mutating. Like every object mutates another object. And I found that really difficult to work with, especially in the async world where you have async requests coming in and you have these like promises and you have objects like set in fields on each other. And I think I monkey patched some Backbone methods just to kind of log everything that happens. But that was still frustrating. So that was like one of the reasons why I wanted to centralize the mutations. And when I saw Flux button, I was like, yeah, like this is exactly the problem that we're trying to solve in our product. So this is like a good answer to how do I avoid all these objects that modify each other? Well, you just put all modifications in a single place. Called this in Flux, it was achieved with different stores, but still each store only mutated the parts that are relevant to it. So like, I wanted to have a higher visibility into all the mutations that happen and all the changes and to be able to debug them better. But I also had this project called React Hot Loader, which is just, I came up with it pretty randomly. I think I was inspired by watching Brad Victor's Inventing on Principle talk. And I have a disclaimer that I'm pretty sure that Brad Victor hates everything that people do after watching his talk. Because like he shows a big vision and then people chase after the 5% that's easy to implement, but forget about the rest of his vision. But yeah, like I did what I could. He had this demo where he would change the code and the changes would be reflected in real time in a running application. And that was really inspiring to me, considering that I had to, like every time I would change a file, I had to wait for like Grunt or whatever I was using at the time to finish building. And in a deeply nested kind of stateful application, like if you're working like combo books or on some widget that only makes sense in the context of your existing data in your app, and you don't want to like build separate fixtures for it. It was really annoying to have to refresh all the time, get the app into the same state and kind of iterate on it. So, and when I was, we migrated to Webpack because of RequireJS. Oh yeah, we were using RequireJS, but it was too slow. So we migrated to Webpack, and I noticed there was this page about hot model replacement, which I had no idea what it is. So I just asked on Stack Overflow, what is hot model replacement in Webpack? And Thomas Coppers, the author of Webpack, actually replied to that. And he gave an overview. So he said that this is like a system that lets you, in a very convoluted way, he explained it like, I mean, he always goes a bit deeper than in terms of implementation details than people usually expect. But he really explained what it does. And it reminded me of when I was 14, I read a book about Erlang. And it had this sentence that since Erlang is a functional language, it's easy to replace modules at runtime. So like you can do deployments of specific modules, if I remember correctly, and just kind of replace them on the fly in a running application. And this is how, if I remember it right, I think this is how some of the networks like telecommunication, like GSM networks, worked at least at the time. So a lot of them were using Erlang, and it was easy to deploy an update because you could just kind of hot swap it.
I think they still are.
Yeah, and so I was, this came to my mind, and I was like, yeah, like this is a similar system, but for JavaScript. But obviously, JavaScript has side effects. So how do you deal with that? But then I realized that in case of React, most of the modules that act with React components don't actually have side effects. So what if I could kind of replace a React component in the fly, but trick React into thinking it's the same component, so it would not throw away the DOM and state, but somehow monkey patch the methods to point to the right version. So you could edit the file and see the changes reflected in the running application without throwing the component away. And this idea fascinated me, and I kind of just sat down one evening and I think I finished at 6 a.m. My wife was like, what is going on here?
You're a maniac.
Yeah, I mean, it's not very healthy, but at that point I was just, I was really fascinated with this idea, and I couldn't stand the thought of like not doing it and then somebody else would do it, and I would feel very silly. So I was like, yeah, I gotta do it. So at 7 a.m. I had a working prototype, which was super hacky. I had to change some code in React to like write to window variables and stuff like this. But it was enough to make a video. So I made this video where I'm editing JSX and see the changes reflected in a live running application. And Christopher Shidori tweeted that. And so this is how I got my first followers. I think before that I had like 20 followers.
I'm almost sure that's when I contacted you and asked you about making videos too. It was probably that retweet that caused that first interaction, I would think.
Maybe, yeah. I'm not sure, but I think it was Christopher who kind of introduced me to the React community this way. And this tweet was like repeated 50 times, and it seemed like a lot. For somebody who doesn't have an audience at all. And I realized this is something people want. And so I just continued working on it basically. And it was super hacky. And due to some issues, it's even more hacky now. But I think eventually it'll be less hacky. But I just felt like this is something I really enjoy, because I like, on the one hand, I like to work on like user experience and on polish. I really like to work in polishing things and making them pleasant to use, and kind of finding those small things that annoy you and try to eliminate them. So I try to do that as a developer, but also I'm really selfish, and I kind of want to do things better for myself or for other developers who are like me. So I think this is why I was motivated to work on this kind of developer experience projects. Because I just like to polish things for people whose workflow I understand. So I do this for developers.
Ultimately to me, like end user experience, at least in part, like developer experience is responsible for that, right? Like if we as developers can have a pleasant experience and while we're writing software, and we should, right? Like we are users and we're using the software, and we should have a pleasant experience, and we should enjoy our job, and we should wake up and be excited about our code instead of, you know, waking up sad that you got to go like, you know, whatever Maven process or some sort of horrible, you know, developer experience that you have to suffer through every single day of your life. I mean, that is ridiculous to me. And user experience starts, you know, like at the coders. We're down at the foundation of it. You know, there's a lot of work down there, but I think we're definitely.
Oh, yeah. I think there's, I don't understand some people who are like trying to present this as some kind of, I think it's a false dichotomy. It's not like you need to subtract from developer experience to get a better user experience. This doesn't make any sense to me. I think if you improve the developer experience, it's just you need to be conscious about how you're improving it and how it's going to have the downstream effects. You want to make it easier for developers to create great products, right? So you want to make sure that they spend less time on obvious things that are like obvious in retrospect, but it's hard to find the issue. They spend less time on typos. They spend less time on like race conditions, on all these hard to debug things. You want them to see the issues clearly. If they don't see what's happening in the app, kind of like it's data flow, it's harder to fix issues, right? And you also want to have an opportunity, like if there is an issue, you want to have a way to ensure that it's reproducible. So that's like another thing that I really was fascinated by when I was talking to Jin Chan, and she told me that Flux architecture allowed us at Facebook at the time, it allowed them to reproduce some bug reports because they would just serialize the actions, and the actions was kind of tell a story of what the user was doing before the bug happened, and you kind of can get close by replaying the same actions. And this was really like, this felt really powerful to me, this idea of having actions be plain objects that you can serialize, you can pass between clients, you can record and then replay. And I think like this is another reason why I like kind of wanted to work on Redux, is I wanted to have this baseline for ensure that there is a baseline for more apps to be able to build tools like this on top of them. And obviously, if you have tools that let you reproduce the issues your users are having, you're going to have better products. It directly impacts the user experience.
So I work with basically two environments. One, we use React on Rails, and we have a big Rails app, and it's like I refresh and I have to wait. And but then when I'm working on like a specific component, I like to fire up Create React App. And more than anything I can think of in the last couple of years, Create React App has like positively affected my development workflow. It's really great. And I was just kind of curious, like, how did that come to be? Is it just kind of a natural progression of this work around developer experience, or what's the story with that?
That's pretty random. I guess there was a lot of frustration in the ecosystem because of all, like, there were a lot of changes going at the same time. There was the bubble 5 to bubble 6 transition. There was the in general, the idea of compiling your JavaScript code kind of went mainstream, and together with Bubble, and it was a big step for a lot of people. And at the same time, you had this the ES6 final specification, and people were just starting to learn. You know, the first update, like the first big update in like 10 years. And it's a lot to learn. And so people felt like they were kind of behind. And they were when they were trying to follow tutorials and examples, a lot of these would be broken because they like specified like a different version of Webpack than the one that is current, or like a different version of Babel. And it felt like a train wreck, like where like there's so much potential in these people who are trying to learn all these technologies, but we just screwed up. Like we didn't provide them with an environment that's that they can learn in, and we didn't provide them with a way to get started that's like working. So it was really frustrating to me personally, I guess. And I was seeing a lot of these boilerplate projects which try to mitigate the problem, but I think some of them actually made it worse, because now you had, like, every time you clone a boilerplate, you end up with all these configs in your project, whether you want them or not. And even if you're a complete beginner and you don't care about customizing anything, now you're left to maintain all this kind of infrastructure that you have no idea how it works, and all these dependencies. And if you try to update any one of them, the rest of them break because they're not compatible. And it takes a lot of effort to learn how to update them. So like, I think this was a big entry barrier to the React ecosystem. And this was one of the reasons why it got such a, I won't say bad reputation, but yeah, in part it was a bad reputation for complexity. And but I don't think that throwing the build tools out the window is the solution. So I was just chatting about this with Christopher Chadeau again. This person's responsible for many of my project systems.
He's awesome.
Yeah, so he was just, they had a hackathon there in Menlo Park office, which I don't usually participate in hackathons because I'm like, I don't know, I just hate context switching, so I prefer to work on one thing at a time. That's just the thing that I'm working on. But he was like, we should do something, let's do something for a while, for a week. And he was talking about this idea of doing a generator for React projects. And I said that I don't want it to be a generator because it's just shifting the problem to the user. Okay, you're going to create a project, but then you have all these dependencies that you have to maintain and all this tooling configuration that I have to do. And so I suggested that what if it was a separate kind of a single dependency that you use this dependency and it builds the project for you, tests the project, it runs the linter, it consolidates all these different tools under a single package. And if there is a new version of some of the underlying tools, we can update the package ourselves and make sure that all of them work correctly together. And if you're not happy with the tools that we've chosen, you can run a check, and then it will copy the build configuration dependencies into your project. And this point is the same as a boilerplate. So there's like an escape hatch. And I got this idea from another project called Enclave, created by Ian Pletter. And so we thought that maybe this will fly. I don't know. I felt like this is either going to be a disaster or it's going to be really helpful. I wasn't sure because there were like four or five projects that attempted to do this before and they failed. So there was a React CLI, React CLI, RWB, there was an internal Facebook project that did that. So there were a bunch of projects that tried to kind of create a first, like an entry point to React, kind of like a curated project generator or something like this, but they were all too opinionated about the project structure or about specific tools and so on. And so they didn't really catch on. And yeah, we just kind of tried to release it and see what happens. And it has its share of issues. I won't deny it. There's like, a lot of people want to customize some things. Some of the things are awkward. People are coming up with workarounds that are more like that are weirder than the problem that we were solving in the first place.
Yeah, so like weird. I've seen some of them.
Yeah, but then on the other hand, I like that there is a way to create a project and it will work and it will be optimized for production correctly. You will not ship a development version of React by mistake. And I've seen people type the command, it works, they have a thing that they can learn React with. And later, if they feel like, oh, I want to do things differently, like, you know, if you want decorators, you probably know enough to go on your own. And like, I don't know, there, I can discuss specific decisions we made there, but overall, I think it's been healthy for the ecosystem to kind of, it pushes hard into the opposite direction from other tools. So like, it's not moderate. It's a little bit on the extreme side of like not allowing you anything at all. And I think that's healthy to shift the overall balance to the middle. And I see us moving closer towards the middle in the future, but I think it's been a helpful kind of purge for the ecosystem.
Well, it's opinionated. Y'all did this and made certain decisions for specific reasons, which gave it an opinion. But it's not. I don't know that it's too opinionated. And like for us, we try to use Create React App up to the point where we just can't anymore. And then we eject and we have a really nice boilerplate that is like sanctioned, right? Like you and your team have sanctioned this for us and we can use it. And it's been really great in our day-to-day development. Aside from people like constantly asking you to add SaaS support, have you noticed like a positive change in terms of the support you have to give for React and kind of in that general space in the community?
I don't see a lot of questions like how do I create an app anymore. So I think that's a really positive change, considering that we had a lot of those questions in the past, and it felt like people were just kind of blindly trying to make different tools work together, and they didn't, and they spent a lot of time on that. So I think that alone is valuable, and I think it also helped to kind of standardize on the language features that we think are solid enough to be enabled by default. And I know we're kind of taking liberties there and we say, yeah, like class properties are fine, but decorators are not. But in practice, it's just some things are going to involve more churn in the future. So like if class properties proposal changes, we're going to write a code mod for it because we are the ones who depend on it. Like all Facebook code base is using class properties. So we can't, we will guarantee, there is a guaranteed migration path in case something happens. But the decorator's proposal has already changed, and the like Bubble implements the old version, and maybe the new version ships in Bubble 6.7, I'm not sure. But in any case, there will be breaking changes there, and people who depend on JS decorator's proposal on the legacy one are going to have to figure out how to update their code, and in some cases they might not even be able to because some pattern might not be supported anymore, or it may have, somebody might have to update the libraries to be compatible with a new syntax. So it's like, is it worth the community churn in this case, considering that Facebook is not going to provide a code mod for this because like we are not using this, so we're not even sure how to write this code mod. I think it's not worth it for the ecosystem. And I think the positive change here is that if some code doesn't work in Create React App, like in a Stack Overflow answer, people are going to rewrite it, and people are going to use the subset of features that we support. And this kind of ensures that everybody speaks the same language, despite everybody using Babel. So I think that's a good thing. And it also helped, I think, less libraries force people to change webpack configs now. There are some cases where we made the situation worse, like with modules that are written in for more recent versions of Node, so we don't compile Node modules. And obviously, if somebody publishes something that uses CSS syntax, it's going to be a problem. So we'll be looking at that. But I think what's been helpful for the ecosystem is that less libraries now say, you need to use me, you also need to go into your webpack config and change this. Because this was not really sustainable. Like, it's very easy to break something if you change the webpack config. It's hard to kind of do this. Like, it can depend on the version of webpack. Not everybody uses webpack. So I'm happy that more libraries now work without configuration. I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, definitely. So I had one last question. I'm a self-taught coder also. I think you are too. And one of the pieces of advice I always give people that are trying to learn to code is read GitHub like it's a blog, reading source code and reading issues, going in there and just really digging in. And that's been like wonderful to me. And I think, you know, it's just a real opportunity for people to learn. And I was wondering if you had any kind of top tips or advice for people that are out there and they're learning to code is kind of a hard uphill climb. And I was wondering if you had any advice that might be able to pass along to people that are trying to just get started and learn how to be a web developer.
I don't know if I have any good advice because it took me a really long time to learn development, even not web development, but like general. I think people are learning much faster than I did in my days. Like, it took me maybe 2 years to really understand what like callbacks are and what async before async await existed. What just like how to write asynchronous code and what it really means to like pass functions around and this kind of stuff. It took me a few years to really get it. And I'm a pretty slow learner, really. But I think what's been helpful to me is just like trying to build things, I guess. Like, I learned everything on the job, really. I was hired to write an iPad app, and in the middle, it was like, hey, we're going to write a web app now. And so I had to throw what I knew, just kind of throw it away and learn it on the go. And so I was just kind of forced to, you know, I have these requirements, I have these screens that need to work this way, and I need to figure out the way to make them work this way. And it was stressful, but that's basically how I learned. I just kind of kept trying to do it. And obviously I had this background of like the things that I read before, you know, it's helpful to read blogs and it's helpful to learn about design patterns and all this kind of stuff. But it's also just by building things that, like real things that you learn how to do it. I would suggest to focus less on like best practices, because a lot of these are like not really valuable. And I think people are way more dogmatic than they need to be. So don't focus too much on that, but just try to focus on kind of making your code easy to change, I guess, but not too flexible. Yeah, that's not really helpful. I think it's just a lot of, as you work on some code and you come back to it once in a while, you learn what things work and what things don't work. And that's really the experience that you need to get to be productive. You want to get a feeling for what you're good at and what you're bad at, and what are you kind of weak spots. And you need to write some code and then see, oh, like I haven't come back to this piece in 2 months because it just works fine. So I guess this is a good way to write the code. And you may write something smart and think like, wow, I was so smart. But then you come back to this piece of code every week and you're like, oh, there is a bug here. And you learn more things about yourself and your workflow and how to structure things by understanding how the code changes over time. But in terms of like the open source, I think your advice is as good as it gets. Just like pick a project that you're using, that you enjoy using, or that looks fun to you, and just try to like, at least for me, a lot of knowledge comes it doesn't make sense at first. So you kind of have to build a tolerance for not understanding things and getting through them anyway. I did that by answering questions. So like, I think the way I learned programming had a lot to do with just answering people questions, even when I didn't know the answer. So I would just hang at it, before Stack Overflow existed, I would hang at like local programming forums, and somebody would ask like, how do I screenshot the screen in like C#? And I have no idea how to do that, but I can Google it. So I'm like, how do I screenshot? And then I found some solution and I tried locally. It doesn't work. I figure out what's wrong. I read about these APIs and this kind of stuff. Eventually I get something working and I post it as an answer. And I did the same after Stack Overflow existed. So like, I would try to answer JavaScript questions. I don't really know the answer to like questions about, I think I answered some questions about Angular just by like Googling things and trying to figure them out. So that, it makes you uncomfortable, but it also, eventually you realize that the people who have like these gold badges and I don't know, like 100Ks of reputation and this kind of stuff, they're not really like much better than you. They're just really good at finding things and then trying to form a theory based on incomplete data, and then explaining what they learned to other people in a way that is more digestible.
It's like programming in a nutshell, though, right? Like, yeah. that's what we do every day. Like, I don't know the answer. I have no idea. We're going to figure it out, though. And by the end of the day, hopefully we have this thing working. Maybe not.
Yeah, I think I get a lot more productive after I realize that. Like, that, yeah, you just need to start doing it and try to figure it out. And if it's not effortless, like right now I'm rewriting some parts of React's build system, just refactoring them because I don't really understand them. I'm trying to understand them. And in the beginning of the day, I was like, oh, this feels so daunting. I don't know where to start. And I just deleted all the code and I just started from scratch and kind of copy and pasting the things that kind of made sense to me. And I got to the point where it actually works now. And so it always feels daunting. This feeling, it never goes away. You always feel like, oh, I don't know what's going on. The only thing that changes is you kind of learn to get through it, I think.
Yeah, and you get those endorphin hits where you feel like a super genius once you've beat the computer for the day, and then the next minute you're back to your normal kind of dumb self.
And that's what keeps a lot of people going, I think. It's just this kind of random reinforcements.
Yeah, stubborn tenacity, right? Like that's one of the core elements, at least for me, that's kept me going.
Yeah, it's the same in open source. You just read through the issues, try to help the people who, like, even if you don't know how this project works, try to reproduce the issue they're having, try to help them, try to, like, form theories about what could go wrong. It's just code, right? You can trace every line and you can see what's really going on if you want to. And eventually you'll gain enough context into a specific library so you're able to contribute with maybe tests or code or documentation or issue triage, which is unappreciated but underappreciated. But this is the thing we want you to help us with. It's like you don't need to go, like, I don't know, write a new feature. That's valuable, but it's 5% of what we're doing. But I think it's way more valuable to go ahead and help the people who are struggling, who have less experience than you, and help, because as you help them, you'll contribute to this ecosystem of people who can explain things to each other and help each other, and maybe they'll create projects that you will use eventually. So it's also selfish in a way, but and as you kind of like, as you do the issue triage and go through the source code and try to read it, even if you don't understand what's going on, still you can read the changes, you can read the commits, and eventually it will start making some sense to you, especially if you use the project and you know the bugs and the issues that that occur to you. And I started open source this way. I just kind of try to send the fixes for the problems that I was dealing with. And some of these fixes were not reviewed for a year, and like nobody cared about my PRs. But some of these were, and it's just a matter of volume, I think, before people really kind of notice you.
Yeah, I mean, the instinct is probably like, oh, I'm going to go do that with React. React might not be the best place to start. Like the React project itself there's a lot of work there. Don't get me wrong. But like in terms of projects, like there is a lot of work there. And, you know, it's kind of more maybe on the advanced side. Than just in general, I think there's a lot of small projects in the ecosystem that are related to React that we might use on a day-to-day basis.
I think it's easier. I think I started contributing to React Router, actually. Like that was one of the first open source projects that I really tried to contribute to, because I was using it and it was like not working the way I wanted it to work. So I try to fix things there. But also, so what we do in the React is we have this tag called good first issue. So if you want to help with development of React, which might involve React itself, might involve our build system, like all kinds of infrastructure we build around it for ourselves, that's also something that we need help with. And so you can go to our GitHub repo at github.com/facebook/react, go to issues tab, filter them by label called good first issue. And they're not all beginner friendly because some of them are complicated, but they all have the difficulty label. So there's like difficulty starter, difficulty medium, difficulty advanced, difficulty maybe impossible, something like this. Regardless of your experience level, you can look at those different issues and just keep track of the label, and when we add it to something, you can take a look, and if you're interested, you can comment saying, hey, I'm interested, and we're going to assign that issue to you. And you can always contact us on that issue by commenting and say, oh, is this the right approach? Is it a good way of doing it? How do I do this and all that? We're happy to answer those questions. And also, you can always reach out to me directly in Twitter direct messages. I don't always reply because it's a bit overloaded, but I try to, especially if you start by saying that you're trying to contribute to React. I'll try to prioritize that. So, yeah, but it's easier to start with smaller projects, I think. You're right.
And I will say it never gets old having your PRs merged into an open source project. It's one of the best feelings. Like I always love it. And, you know, I had like a 2 lines of code in the AngularJS code base, and you know, I was always patting myself on the back. It's just nice, right? Like when you get to feel like you're giving back to this community that gives so much to you.
Yeah. Totally.
All right, Dan. I really appreciate it. Thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Cheers. Thank you.